Well, sometimes when we pray, we think God is not going to listen to me. Well, he might, but he'll be like this, passive, indifferent. He's unlikely to lift his little finger to help me with this issue or assist me with that problem. And yet, intellectually, we know from the Bible that none of that is true. When I was in the sixth grade, my little sister, Debbie, was in the first grade. And one morning, she and I were walking to school, and we decided to take a shortcut. It was a mistake. Down the alley through which we cut lived a large, vicious dog that was neither on a leash nor behind a fence. And initially, we didn't see the dog, but he spotted us. He sneaked up behind us, growled, showed us his teeth, and then he began his charge coming straight at us. My sister and I were so scared, we couldn't say anything. But we could run, so we took out running for the school. Being a 12-year-old boy, I easily outran and left behind my 6-year-old sister. But I didn't dare turn over my shoulder to look, fearing that vision would verify what mentally I suspected to be the case. I was getting further ahead of her while that dog was getting closer to her heels. So I just kept looking and running straight ahead for the school, hoping against hope that some way, somehow, she was going to catch up with me and we would both outrun that dog. I kept running straight ahead until she shouted out, "Ronnie, help me." When I heard her desperate cry for help, something surprising took place in my heart. I suddenly lost all fear for myself, stopped, turned 180 degrees, and started running at that dog. My sister and I passed each other. She kept running toward the school. She was going to let me take on this land shark all by myself. And you ask, were you afraid? Oh, yes, of course. Years earlier, as a smaller child, I was bitten by a large dog. And to this day, I am wary around big dogs. In fact, God didn't make big dogs. The devil did. And as that dog and I were closing in on each other, I didn't know exactly what to do. So I threw up my hands and shouted as loud as I could, standing off on the side over here, "Must have been the Lord," because he threw panic in the heart of that beast. And I can still remember in my mind's eye that dog's facial expression changing from being angry and fierce to being frightened. And he became so scared of me because he'd been running so fast at me, he slammed on his brakes and he started sliding head first. Then he didn't mean to, but he turned and started sliding sideways toward me. He came to a complete stop. He was so eager to get away from me. For a moment, he couldn't find any traction. You could hear his nails scratching on the concrete. He eventually found traction and off he went. And I was shocked. That monster had been afraid of me. My sister had turned long enough to see all of that. When I caught up with her, she was most impressed. "Wow," she said. "Were you afraid?" "Of course not," I said. I didn't tell the truth. Now, my response to my sister's cry for help is a dim reflection of the heart of God. When we approach God with a heavy heart and cry out for help, he cannot be indifferent and just stand there passively like that. In our passage this morning, two different people with different problems approach the Lord and cry out for help. And what's his response? He stops dead in his tracks, listens, and then he gives them the much-needed helping hand that they're asking for. Not only do these people make requests of him, they either want to reach out and touch Jesus, or they want Jesus to touch their sick, needy loved ones. And in our passage this morning, there is an awful lot of touching going on. Now, I want you to find this insert in your bulletin, and I want to just point out the touching that's involved. Would you look, now if you don't have a handout, you're going to be lost. Does anybody need this handout? If you do, I'm sure an usher will be glad to bring one to you. Is anybody without the handout? Okay, there's a lady right here in the middle. Thank you very much. All right, thanks. Now, I want you to look at verse 23, the last line. Here a dad says to Jesus, "Please come, lay your hands on her, my little sick girl." Skip down to verse 27, the second line. Now here comes a woman. She came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. Verse 28, second line. "If I just touch his clothes, I will get well." Verse 30, the last line. Jesus asks, "Who touched my clothes?" Verse 31, the disciples answered, "You see the multitude crowding against you." The fact that the multitude was crowding against Jesus, they were touching him. "And yet you ask, who touched me?" Then on the back of the handout, verse 41, Jesus took her, the little girl, by the hand. The very fact that he took her by the hand, what does that indicate? That he touched her. Now, all this touching raises a question. Have you ever felt cheated because you did not live when Jesus was upon the earth, why might we feel shortchanged? Had we lived long ago in Israel when Jesus was here, then we could have actually seen him with our own eyes, touched him with our hands, heard him with our ears. We could have brought our problems straight to him for personal advice. We could have been taught directly by him. And we could have asked him to lay his hands on our sick, needy loved ones. But here we are, over 2,000 years after Jesus has left this planet and gone back to heaven. So have you and I been cheated and shortchanged? Jesus foresaw this question, and in a conversation with Thomas, he said, "Blessed are those who have not seen, blessed, but still believe." So you and I have not been shortchanged, and this is what our passage deals with. Now, you'll notice at the top of the handout, I have summed up our whole text in one sentence. Here is the bottom line. In times of need, we obtain God's help by faith, not by touch. Or I can put it this way. Today, we touch the Lord with our faith, not with our hands. And you'll notice that our passage breaks down into three paragraphs. Here they are. A desperate dad, verses 21 through 24, middle paragraph, a determined woman, and on the back, the last paragraph is a dead daughter. Now let's take our passage and quickly work our way through what I think will be not only an instructive, but an encouraging passage as well. Now, verse 21, Jesus returns from the other side of the Lake of Galilee. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him. Now, where's Jesus coming from? The regions of the Gadarenes. He cast a legion of demons out of a possessed man. The demons went into a herd of pigs who rushed off into the water and drowned. And when the nearby villagers came out and discovered that they had lost all their bacon and sausage, they were very upset and they told Jesus, "Get out of our neighborhood." So being the gentleman that he was, he got into a boat with the 12 and he crossed over from the region of the Gadarenes to the other side of the lake. And what does verse 21 say? When he got to the other side of the lake, here was a large, enthusiastic crowd that, so to speak, rolls the red carpet out for Jesus. They are glad to have him back on their side of the lake. Now, what is the Bible telling us here? And by the way, look at the last line of verse 21. Consequently, Jesus stayed by the shore. Because this crowd on the other side of the lake is so glad, happy to have him back, he gives them time in a busy schedule he can ill afford. Now, what is verse 21 telling you and me? There will always be some people who want nothing at all to do with God. On the other hand, there will be some people who are open to him. And you have undoubtedly seen this in your own dealings with people. There are some people you attempt to talk to about the Lord, and they tell you, "I am not interested. Don't hear any more of that." There are other people you speak to, and you sense the Lord has prepared them for this moment. They're wide open. They drink in everything you tell them about the gospel. Now, verse 22 focuses on a single individual. One of the synagogue officials named Jairus, let's stop right there. Being a synagogue official meant he was in charge of the worship service that took place every Sabbath in his local synagogue. One of the synagogue officials made a beeline for Jesus. Now, admittedly, that's not exactly what the Greek text says. You'll notice in parentheses, what the text literally says is, he came toward Jesus. How do I justify translating he came toward Jesus into he made a beeline for him? In the Greek text, the verb he came toward is in the emphatic position. It just sticks out like a sore thumb. And it arrests a person's attention when he reads that. And so when it says he came toward him, it conveys Jairus focuses attention on Jesus like a laser beam. And he went straight at him. He didn't detour to the left. He wasn't sidetracked to the right. He let nothing and nobody get between him and Jesus. And notice how verse 22 ends. Upon reaching him, Jairus fell at his feet. Now let's stop and think about that. This is most unusual. Here is a local religious leader falling at the feet of a supposedly despised carpenter from Nazareth. And it's worse than that. We're in Mark chapter 5. Do you remember what the religious leaders in Jerusalem said about Jesus? He is possessed of Beelzebub. He's full of the devil. Everybody stay away from Jesus. But here's a religious leader that not only doesn't stay away from him, he falls at his feet.
And what drives this man to his knees? Verse 23, Jairus pleaded earnestly with him, saying, my little daughter is close to death. Now, Jairus reminds me of a man I once knew named Andrew. When his wife Mary was converted to Christ, she began to earnestly talk to Andrew about becoming a Christian, as she had. And Andrew's response was, I am too intelligent to believe all those myths and fairy tales from the Bible. Keep that nonsense to yourself. That was his attitude until one of their two little daughters fell so ill that, like the daughter of Jairus, the physician said, we may not be able to help your daughter. She may well die. That drove Andrew to his knees. And he cried out and said, God, if you'll have mercy and spare my little girl, I'm not saying I'll become a Christian, but I'll start reading the Bible. The Lord did spare that little girl. And true to his word, Andrew started reading the Bible and he eventually became a Christian. So what drives Jairus to his knees? Back home, he has a huge problem. Now look at his request in the last line of verse 23. Please come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed and live. Is it necessary, I'm asking you, for Jairus, for Jesus to go to the home of Jairus? Does he have to touch that little girl in order to heal her? Does he? No. You remember in Luke chapter 4, there was a Roman soldier whose servant became very ill, and he sent friends to Jesus saying, Lord, would you please heal my servant? Now, Jesus, you don't have to come to my home to do it. In fact, I'm not good enough that you should come under my roof. Because of your authority, just speak the word. And because of your authority, from where you are, despite the miles, the distance to my home, my servant will be healed. Now, there, that Roman soldier had a theologically correct and a strong faith. Jairus, he's got faith. He believes that Jesus can help. But his faith is theologically incorrect, and it is weak. And of course, Jesus is not going to honor that kind of faith, is he? Look at verse 24. So Jesus went off with him. I find that very encouraging. And the reason I do is this. This morning I have faith in Christ. But it may well be my faith is not as theologically correct, as strong and mature as the Lord wants it to be. And yet the Lord still responds to and honors our faith. And it may well be your faith this morning. I don't doubt that you've got confidence and trust in the Lord. But there's a good chance that your faith, like mine, like the faith of Jairus, is not as strong and mature and correct as it should be. I like what Hebrews 12 says about Jesus. He is the author and the perfecter of our faith. He takes our weak, flawed faith and he deepens it. He grows it. He matures it. He gradually makes our faith more and more to what it should be. Now, in the last line of verse 24, we have a problem. But a massive multitude was following Jesus and pressing against him. Luke's gospel puts it this way. The multitude was choking Jesus. Now, choking him, not in the sense that they had their hands around his neck, but they were so eager to get close to Jesus that they squeezed, and the pressure from the crowd almost squeezed, choked the breath of life out of Jesus. When I was a senior in high school down in Jackson, Mississippi, where I'm from, some local merchants put on an advertising campaign on the radio and in the newspaper, and they informed the public, at a certain day and certain hour, we're going to be on top of a certain building in downtown Jackson, and we're going to throw ping pong balls off the top of the building to the crowd below. Each ping pong ball will contain a dollar bill from $1 up to $100 denomination, or a gift certificate that you can redeem for free merchandise in their stores. Well, I was interested in free money and gifts like everybody, and I was foolishly in the middle of that big crowd at the bottom of the building. When the ping pong balls were thrown off, the crowd rushed together to get them, and for about a minute, the pressure, the squeeze from that crowd was so great, I could not breathe. And I was afraid I was going to be suffocated to death. And I shouted out, let me out of here. Never mind the ping pong balls. And when I somehow managed to worm my way out of that crowd, I felt like I'd won the state lottery. I didn't have any money, any free gifts. I got away with something a whole lot better, my life. Now, Jairus is in a rush to get Jesus home to his little girl before she dies. And if I hadn't been Jairus, I would have been shouting out loud, everybody, please open up like the Red Sea and let Jesus through. My little daughter is about to die. And I wouldn't just be shouting. I would put my hands on the shoulders of one person near Jesus and peel him off. And then put my shoulders on the hands of another person and peel him off, trying to get Jesus through that crowd. He needs an ambulance to put Jesus in and get him through that crowd. Let me tell you about Larry. He was a classmate of mine at Dallas Seminary. Today he's pastoring a church in his home state of Oregon. Larry is one of those rare people that draws lightning. What I mean by that is whatever bad can happen to a person happens to him. He was fishing down in the Gulf of Mexico and out on a little island off the Mississippi coast. And they caught a lot of fish. And then all of a sudden, for quite some time, they didn't even get a bite. And he told his brother that he was fishing with, let's swim out to that little sandbar, and maybe the fish will bite out there. Larry foolishly takes the string of fish on a nylon rope, ties it around his waist, and they start swimming out to the sandbar. Immediately something grabbed him, that string of fish, and took him down. He said, I knew what it was. It was a huge shark, and sure enough, it was. And he saw the shark, and the shark was taking him out to deep water, and Larry said, I knew what that shark was going to do. He was going to drown me. And in just a few minutes, I was going to be looking Jesus in the face. And he says he remembers his back touching the bottom and looking up, and through the water, he could see the blue sky. And the shark got him out to deep water, and the shark cleaned off that fish on the string and let him go. After that, he moved back to Oregon. He was working as a lumberjack, and one day a huge tree fell on him. And Larry turned around, and he saw the tree coming at him, and he didn't have enough time to go that way or that way. And Larry said, I knew in just a moment I was going to be looking Jesus in the face. I was going to be killed. And the tree struck him, but it didn't kill him. It did injure him. And as a result of the injury, he got a nice settlement from the insurance company, and that's what paid his expenses through Dallas Seminary. There are easier ways to pay for an education, but that's the way he did it. Well, while we were students at Dallas Seminary one day, his little 1-2-year-old daughter swallowed a key. It lodged in her windpipe, cut off of the breathing. She turned blue. Now, he's got one thing on his mind. Emergency room at a local hospital. Takes his little daughter, puts her in the back seat of his Volkswagen Bug, his Volkswagen Beetle, and it's off to the emergency room. But unfortunately for Larry, it's 5 p.m. downtown, bumper-to-bumper Dallas traffic. Doesn't matter to Larry. He just cuts in and out of all those cars. What about a stop sign? Runs right through them. What about stop lines? Stop light, red lights. Never minds him. He blows right through those as well. He eventually catches the attention of a Dallas police officer who doesn't know about the suffocating little girl in the back seat. He just sees a wild man driving recklessly. So his siren comes on. Larry sees his flashing red lights in the rearview mirror, but he doesn't have the patience of a Jairus. He doesn't stop, explain the situation to the cop, and ask for an escort. He keeps weaving in and out all the traffic, and the cop's right behind him, weaving in all the traffic. Larry comes to the hospital. He jumps out. He's got his little girl under this arm. He's got his car keys in this hand. And he's racing toward the door of the emergency room. The cop cuts him off and jumps out. And Larry takes his keys and throws them to the cop and says, here, go park my car for me. And I told him, brother, you had a lot of gall. You made that cop chase you all the way across town. And then you threw your keys to him and ordered him, didn't ask, ordered him to park your car. Now, when they took the key out of your little daughter's throat, she was okay, and you came out, and that cop was waiting on you. Did he say anything to you? Just one thing. Boy, you sure can drive that car. Jairus doesn't have the vigor that Larry did to get through that crowd. And making matters worse is verse 25. A woman was there who had been troubled with a hemorrhage of blood for 12 years. Now, we all know what's going to happen. She's going to come up in the crowd, touch Jesus. He's going to turn around and carry on a conversation with her. Had I been Jairus, I would have said to that woman, listen, my little daughter, the clock's running out on my little girl. She's about to die. Please don't slow Jesus up. This is a case of children before adults. Besides, you've been suffering for 12 years with your problem. What's another hour or two to you? See that tree over there? Go stand by it. Let me have Jesus to myself. And as soon as Jesus takes care of my little girl, I'll personally bring Jesus to that tree, and he can help you. But right now, don't get in the way. That's not what happened. Verse 25. A woman was there who had been troubled with a hemorrhage of blood for 12 years. Now, why didn't she consult a doctor? 26. She had suffered greatly under the treatment of many physicians, and she had spent all her money. Instead of her health improving the slightest bit, she actually grew worse. Is it wise for you and me to consult a medical profession? Of course. It's just that sometimes they're limited in what they can do to help us. Now, she has one ray of hope, verse 27. When she heard about Jesus. Let's stop right there. What had this lady heard about Jesus earlier? She had heard what he had done to help other people. Now, years ago, I had a girl at Moody from Kansas. And when she was in high school, she was already an alcoholic. And she said, I knew alcohol was killing me, but I could not quit drinking it. One day she heard a man tell, not her, tell others. She overheard him tell others how Christ had delivered him from drug addiction. And she reasoned, if Christ got him off drugs, maybe the Lord can get me off alcohol. What she heard him say was enough to bring her to Jesus. She was eventually saved. The Lord did take her off alcohol, cleaned her life off, and brought her to Moody. Now, this coming week, next month, there are going to be people who hear you say how God helped you with this issue or that problem. And what they hear you say may be the one thing heaven uses to bring that person to the Lord. So, verse 27. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him and touched his cloak. Now, why did she want to do that? 28. For she kept saying to herself, if I just touch his clothes, I will get well. Question. Is she correct about that? She's only half right. She's correct in thinking, here's somebody who can help me. She's incorrect in thinking, in order to get his help, I must touch his clothes. So she too, like Jairus, has a flawed, weak, not completely theologically correct faith. But verse 29 reveals the effect of her flawed faith. And immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she had been healed of her ailment. And not only was she aware of what happened, but according to verse 30, so was the Lord. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. Where did that power go from? Him. Where did it go? To. Into that needy woman. I envy this woman. She got what I need, the power of God. And why do I need God's power? To help me deal with temptations, to help me be a good, loving husband to my wife and a good dad to my boys, to help me daily instruct and teach and mentor my students at Moody, to get me through the storms and the crises of life. And I reason this way. If she, and who was this woman? She wasn't a biblical scholar, a spiritual giant, a famous missionary. She was a common, ordinary person with a weak, flawed faith. And if I need the power of God, chances are you need it too. And I reason this way. If she got the power of God with a weak, flawed faith, I can do that too. Now look at the third line of verse 30. Turning around the crowd, he asked, who touched my clothes? Now I want to draw your attention to an apparently unimportant word. In the last line of verse 30, the initial word, who. I want you to know that in Greek, that's an interrogative pronoun that is singular in number, and it can be translated, what individual touched me? This is an amazing fact, folks. Jesus is surrounded. In fact, he's almost being choked by a huge, massive crowd. Lots of people are touching him. And yet he is very aware of this one needy individual. Many people were touching Jesus, but he's aware of her. Now, we saw in the video clip at the beginning of our service, the higher we go from earth, the smaller it gets. We lose sight of earth. In fact, we lose sight of our sun. And we can go so high, our own Milky Way, we can't even pick out at it anymore. This morning, while God is concerned with trillions of affairs throughout the universe and innumerable angels, and he's concerned with billions of people upon the earth, he never loses sight of you as an individual. But it goes further than that. Remember what Jesus told his disciples? Don't you guys know that God has numbered every hair on your head? You know what the book of Psalms says about the people of God? That the Lord counts each step we take daily. He keeps every tear we have ever shed in a bottle. That's a figurative way of saying he never forgets every tear that we've shed and what caused that tear to drop. Note the disciples' response in verse 31. But his disciples answered, "You see the multitude crowding against you, and yet you ask, 'Who touched me?'" Now here's another amazing fact. Many people touched Jesus, but how many went home having benefited from it? Just one. And why is that? Was this woman the only needy person who needed help? No. Probably everybody in the crowd had some problem that they were dealing with. She was the only one in the crowd who brought her need to Jesus to get his help. And in verse 32, the Lord is intent to identify the needy person. Nevertheless, Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. And in verse 33, this lady realizes she's been found out. Then the woman, becoming fearful and starting to tremble, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and told him the whole truth. The point Jesus wants clearly understood is stated in verse 34. But he responded to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you." Without that remark, the second line in verse 34, I would resent this whole passage. Why? Today, unlike the people back then, I cannot see Jesus. I cannot reach out my hand and touch him. But notice what he says. It's not the touch of your hand that has healed you. It is your faith. And what kind of faith? Weak, flawed, not completely theologically correct. And again, I reason, if she got the power and the help of God through her weak faith, again, I can do that. You can do that as well. So he tells her at the end of verse 34, "You may go in peace and remain free from your ailment." Well, that story ends happily. But what about Jairus' problem? While Jesus dealt with her, his problem deteriorated and got worse. Verse 35, while Jesus was still speaking, some servants came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue official. They said, "Your daughter has just died. Why bother? In fact, don't bother the teacher anymore." One commentator pins these words, "We give hospitality to strange ideas. Do we propose to dispense with Christ just when we need him most?" Now, what did Jesus do? Deliberately dragged his feet. He intentionally slowed up and let that little girl die. Why? To strengthen the faith of Jairus, to increase his patience, and to wait until Jairus' problem got so bad it was beyond human help. And that when the Lord stepped in and dealt with it, it would be clear God did it. The Lord senses Jairus is about to give up. And so he says in 36, but Jesus, overhearing their conversation, said to the synagogue official, "Stop fearing, only persist in your faith." And what kind of faith? Weak, flawed, deficient faith. You dealing with a problem this morning? Is it getting worse? You about to give up and quit? I think what Jesus said to Jairus, he would say to you and me, don't fear, just keep believing. Hang on. I'm at work. I haven't finished yet. And verse 37, Jesus turns full attention to the issue. And he permitted no one to accompany him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And what does Jesus find in the home of Jairus? Verse 38. So they came into the synagogue official's house, and he saw bedlam, specifically weepers and mourners in profound grief. Here is the world's view of death. They have no hope of ever seeing this little girl alive again. And in verse 39, Jesus raises a question. Entering in, he asks them, "Why are you making such commotion? And why are you wailing? The child has not died, but is merely asleep." Now, is Jesus right about that? No. He is dead wrong. This little girl's not asleep. She is dead. But let's look at that word asleep. I want you to know that in the Greek language, there are two different words that are both translated by our same English word, sleep. The first word is kathudo. This is what we did last night. We all went to bed and we kathudo. We physically, literally slept. But the word that's used here is not kathudo, it's number two, koimao. This means, this pictures physical death merely as a human body being temporarily put to sleep. Now, years ago, my family was in New Zealand. One day we were walking through a cemetery, and we came across a grave, and in the marble of the tombstone were penned these words. The parents put, "Here lies our precious little boy who was put to sleep by the finger of God." Did you know that that's theologically, that's biblically correct? I want you to look at 1 Thessalonians 4:14. Now, this is my translation from the Greek text of this verse. "If we believe that Jesus died and rose again, so also God will bring with him those who were put to sleep by Jesus." Now, little children have a well-earned reputation of not wanting to go to bed at night. They're afraid, if asleep, they're going to miss out on something exciting. So what do loving parents do? We put our children to bed. We make them go to sleep so their little minds and body get all the rest necessary to grow properly and stay healthy. In like manner, when our earthly work is done, our loving Heavenly Father knows when it's time to put His children to sleep. So when Jesus says she's asleep, He's using a figure of speech called euphemism. Euphemism is taking, saying something harshly in a much more gentle, polite manner. And euphemism likens physical death to sleep. Why? Well, a number of reasons. For one reason, there is a similarity in appearance between a sleeping body and a dead body. Secondly, sleep denotes peace and rest. Thirdly, a sleeping person doesn't cease to exist, and neither does a dead person. And fourthly, sleep implies waking up. Is that all that we have, all the points on that euphemism we have there? I think that's it. So when Jesus says she is merely asleep, He means she is in the sleep of death. And what do the mourners think about this? Verse 40, in response they began laughing Him to scorn. But He personally ejected them all. And taking along the child's father and mother and the disciples coming to Him, Jesus went into where the child was. And notice a touching in 41, taking her by the hand. Now remember, why does Jesus take her by the hand? He could have stayed out in the front yard. And like Lazarus said to Lazarus, come forth. He could have awakened from death this little girl just by speaking to her. Why does He take her by the hand? Probably because to meet her father's request. His request was, please go and lay your hand on her. And also, I think, to show that the Lord doesn't hesitate to get His hands dirty with our problems. Did you know back in ancient Israel, nobody would dare touch a human corpse because they thought it would defile them? Jesus doesn't hesitate to do it. And I think Jesus is also showing His compassion. When I was a student at Dallas Seminary one day, I had a huge problem that lasted for months. And one morning after the worship service at church, I with such a heavy heart, I left the church building and went out in the parking lot and just stood there in grief. My pastor came out, came up behind me and put his arm around my shoulder, never said a word to me. For 1 minute, he stood there in silence. And I interpreted his arm around the shoulder as his way of saying, I know the problem you're dealing with. I know you got a heavy heart. And because you're hurting, I'm hurting with you and praying for you. And then after about a minute, took his hand off my shoulder and walked away. That's the most cherished memory I have of that pastor, showing compassion. And I think Jesus taking this dead little girl by the hand was His way of showing compassion. He said, Talitha kum, that's Aramaic, which means little girl awaken. I just suspect every morning her mother went into her room and said these very words, Talitha kum, honey, get up, it's time to dress and go to school. Was she too far gone to be helped? Verse 42, immediately the child stood up and began walking around, for she was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. And our text ends in verse 43. Jesus gave strict orders that no one should learn about this. He also said that something should be given her to eat. Now, why that last statement? Feed this little girl. Well, down in Chicago some years ago, a young man was involved in a serious traffic accident. He received an injury to his brain. He lapsed into a coma. And they didn't know when or if he would ever wake up. Well, his father happened to be in his son's hospital room when, without any warning, the son opened his eyes, woke up, and said, man, I'm hungry. Has anybody got anything to eat? And the dad said, when I heard my boy say he was hungry, I knew he was going to be okay. What does the appetite indicate on the part of this little girl? She's not only alive, she is alive and well. Now, as we look back over our passage, what is it saying to us? Well, I think several things by way of application. Firstly, Christ responds to our weak, flawed faith. Jairus had that kind of faith. So did this woman with the hemorrhage of blood. And the Lord responded to it and met their needs. The Lord's not going to wait until our faith is as mature and strong as it should be to respond to us. He gladly does it now. Secondly, remember, it's not the touch of the hand, but the touch of our faith that brings God's power to bear in our life. We can't even touch the Lord with our hand yet. Someday we're going to be able to. But right now we can touch Him with our faith. That's what brings His power to bear. Thirdly, the Lord never loses sight of you and me as individuals. Now, you and I are finite, limited people. We can deal with only so many people, and every once in a while, it happens to you, it happens to me. Somebody falls through the crack. We forget that phone call we were going to make or that visit that we were going to take to that person's house. We didn't mean to neglect or overlook that person, but we sometimes do. The Lord never let you and me fall through the crack. We're never from out of His mind. Fourthly, prior to dealing with our problem, Jesus may intentionally let it get worse. What would He say? Don't fear. Don't quit believing. Just hang on. We need to remember that the Lord's very punctual. He's not premature. He's not tardy. He knows what time it is, and He also knows when best to deal with the problem. Fifthly, as parents and future parents, let's take a page out of Jairus' book. We too can bring Jesus to deal with our children. We can ask Him to pay our children a visit. Sixthly, we can be part of the crowd that benefits from proximity to Jesus by bringing our needs to Him. Now, we've got a nice group here this morning. You and I don't want to be the only person in this crowd this morning that goes home without any benefit from being here. If we have needs and problems, let's do what these two needy people did. Let's bring those issues, those burdens of heart to the Lord. And lastly, is that it? Okay, that's it. Heavenly Father, thank You for preserving this story for our instruction, for the encouragement it gives us. And may we remember that You will now only too gladly respond to our faith as it is. And may we remember that we can touch You today, not yet with a hand, but with our faith, and obtain Your help, Your power in our life. May we be those who experience what Jairus and this lady did in days to come. We ask in Your holy name. Amen.
Would the men come forward to serve our communion?